welcome to this Leap of Faith special. I'm Michael Cummin. Well, Pope Francis is aboard an Alitalia aircraft, flight number 4000, currently on its final approach to Dublin Airport. And between now and 11, we'll bring you reports from the airport, hear from contributors, and look at what will unfold over the next 36 hours. The 266th leader of the Catholic Church touches down on Irish soil for his first time since 1980, when as a young priest he studied English for 3 months with the Jesuit community at Milltown Park in Dublin. Our panel in the studio this morning includes Father Brian Shortall, a Capuchin priest based in St Mickens Parish in Smithfield in Dublin, close to the Capuchin Day Centre. Brian is due to meet with Pope Francis later this afternoon. We're also joined by Dr. Anne Thurston. Anne is a writer and theologian, and we'll be talking to Anne about the changing expectations for the Catholic Church here and globally. And we're also joined this morning by Dr. Dahi O'Coron, lecturer in history in the School of History and Geography at Dublin City University, who'll help us trace back the change in Ireland's relationship with the Catholic Church.
The Pope in Ireland on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning to you all. Welcome to the programme. Father Brian, I'm going to start with you. You already have an app open in front of you, which I believe gives us some very valuable information about what's happening.
Do you want the background?
Go on, yes, you can very quickly.
I'm an anorak. I love aircraft. I've been an airplane fan ever since my dad brought me to the old runway 23 in Dublin Airport as a kid. And I suppose my pals' fathers brought their kids to Croker. Yeah. And so I suppose I've been more drawn to the airfield in Dublin Airport than maybe I have to the hallowed ground of Croke Park. So I often tell people the first thing I noticed when I was almost 10 in 1979 in the 15 acres in the Phoenix Park wasn't Pope John Paul II. It was Aer Lingus EIASI Sierra India call sign St. Patrick as it flew low, escorted by the air corps down around the along the Liffey and banking to the right over the park. That was what I noticed first. So I've been watching the app there, just watching its progress. Alpha Zulu, Alitalia at 4,000 as it makes its way. I think it's almost there.
Yeah, but 12 minutes to run, according to that one. Yeah. You're, along with the other Capuchins in the city, you're the Pope's coalface workers, I suppose, the way of describing you. How do you see the importance of this visit?
Oh, listen, we are very, very honoured. We're chuffed. We're very excited. We're delighted for ourselves. We're delighted for the work that Brother Kevin Crowley and Brother Sean Donoghue and the team do there in the Capuchin Day Centre. We're delighted because Pope Francis is someone who reaches out to the marginalised. Endeavours to reach out to the peripheries, we are aware that he does try to meet with people on the margins, like for example homeless and people who are poor and so on. So for Pope Francis to kind of come to the Capuchin Day Centre is a wonderful honour for the order, obviously, but for all people who work in homeless services and try to reach out to people who aren't as fortunate.
Dr. Anne Thurston, good morning to you. Anne, you were just saying there before we came in about the idea that with all of the stress and the tension that's been around in advance of this visit, you reckon that Irish hospitality kicks in at this point, is that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's terribly important that we welcome this person. I think this would be totally against our culture if we didn't. We need to be hospitable, and we can also be hospitable to difference. And being hospitable doesn't mean not engaging in dialogue, doesn't mean not allowing the critical voices to be heard, and they will be heard. But it certainly means welcoming him.
And Dr. Dahi O'Coran, Dahi, welcome again to the programme to you. We are going to make some comparisons later on about this and 1979. But as an historical visit, and historians may look at this in the future, can you throw your mind forward and what they might be thinking?
Well, I think when the leader of the largest transnational institution in the world with 1.2 billion adherents visits your country, that in itself is very historic. It is only the second papal visit to Ireland. And it comes at a very delicate juncture in Francis's papacy.
Mm. Brian, then let's look at the day-to-day implications of what's happening and what's changing. I want to go back to this idea of the practical applications of a faith, and that's what you find yourselves doing as an order.
Yes, well, I mean, we work in several, you know, different ministries. I mean, we have hospital chaplains, we have, you know, men, capuchins in parish ministry. We have, you know, we have industrial chaplaincies, if you like to call it that. I mean, we've one man out working in West Dublin as a chaplain to the Blanchardstown Centre. We have people, you know, in working, as I said, you know, the Kevin and Sean and the work in the Capuchin Day Centre for homeless, diverse, you know, work and ministries, and practically speaking, we engage with people, and I suppose the wonderful thing about Capuchins working in ministry is that we endeavour to work together with others. You know, we're not bosses. We're networkers. We hope, and we, you know, it's something that we kind of collaborative ministry, collaborative relationship. So you know, we are very privileged to be kind of engaged with that.
Okay, what about the man himself? Let's find out a little bit more. Elisabetta Piquet is an Italian-born Argentine journalist and Vatican correspondent for La Nación newspaper. She wrote the biography Pope Francis, Life and Revolution, and became great friends with the man she calls Padre Jorge, to the extent that both her children were baptised by Francis while he was still a cardinal. Elisabetta is on that actual papal flight from Rome, and earlier I spoke to her about her first meeting with the new cardinal.
It was very impressive to meet this man that now you see that is a man that is a kind of a star with the media. In that moment, you would see a priest that was really, when I met him in this living room of this Casa del Clero, it was really very, very shy. He was like very shy. So I felt, well, I tried to break the ice. So I told him, look, really, I'm coming from Jerusalem to covering the Second Intifada. I really don't understand much about church, etc. So to break the ice. I was very surprised. He was being made cardinal the day after, so he was already a cardinal, but he didn't have this kind of, he wasn't a prince bishop, these kinds of bishop that look at you from up to down, but very straight. And then I was surprised because when I started the interview, all my questions, he would respond in a very direct way and in a way that I was thinking with my journalistic mentality, well, this could be a headline, the first answer. Then the second answer, this could be a headline also. The more striking thing for me was that, let's say, 2 or 3 days later, when this interview was published by my newspaper, the telephone rang in my home, and it was him. It was, hello, Elisabetta, this is Padre Bergoglio. And I thought, what I had written, maybe he's... And he said, I just phoned to tell you thank you for the interview. You were asking me which difference I see now that he's a pope. Well, I would say that I think that the thing that I more appreciate having known him before is that he, of course, he's the pope. Now everybody's watching what he says, what he does. He's a pope that is very popular because people realize that he is authentic. He's still himself. He's still, at least for me, Padre Jorge, because he didn't change. He keeps being a pastor with his foot on the ground, very open. This is a man, I think, Padre Jorge is a man of action. He's not a man of words. When he says something, it's because he means it, and he does it. And I think, and as I said before, he's a man of government. He has good health, good spirit, great inner peace, and he knows very well. It's true that the abuse question is a terrible issue that he, as Pope, has understood more. The letter he wrote some days ago to the people of God shows he's very conscious that the church had not protected the little ones. And I see really that he's very determined, and he has an inner freedom that makes him do things that other predecessor wouldn't do. And this is something that it's a big advantage.
You used the word earlier on that he was a government person, or is he an insight into government? Using the labels of government, is he a conservative or a liberal?
He's not black or white. But I would say that this is a pope that is very concerned about the gap between rich and poor. And this is because he has this Latin American experience, and it's one of the big achievements of this pope is that to have transformed this idea of a church that will be there to condemn you and to judge you, a church, open, an open church, a church that would be there to accompany and to accompany the people, the wounded people. And telling this, I'm trying to respond that it's totally impossible to say, well, this is liberal or he doesn't like to be classified liberal, progressive. He's a free man. He has never studied in Rome and he has not a Roman mentality. And for that reason, it's a pope that is totally different from his predecessors. And a pope that, for that reason, in my book, I spoke about revolution, of course, a revolution not in the sense of the Cuban revolution, but the revolution of following Jesus.
Elizabeth Piquet there, who's on the papal flight as part of the Media Corps. Well, our panel this morning are Father Brian Shortall, Dr. Anne Thurston, and historian Dr. Dahi O'Cahon, or Coran, should I say, Dahi. Anne, if I come back to you there for just a moment. In that interview, we heard Elizabeth mention a revolution. What's Francis revolting against?
Well, I thought she said something very significant there when she said that Francis did not study in Rome. So perhaps he has a certain freedom from some of the Roman traits of the church. And I sometimes think about the unholy trinity in the church of clericalism, legalism and sexism. And these seem to me to be viruses which are infecting the church. We have to ask what they should be replaced by. You could talk about things like they need to be replaced by accountability, by transparency, by justice, and most of all by humanity. Humanity and how they deal with people. I remember when I studied theology first a long time ago, the first book that was given to me was a book by the wonderful Dutch theologian Skillebex, and the title of the book was The Church with a Human Face. And one of the hopeful things when this papacy started was that Francis showed a human face. Now, I think he is in extremely lonely and isolated position because I am not at all convinced that he has support around him. And in fact, that was one of the things that came across to me in that film. You saw an isolated man. So I've got a sense that he has a curia there and they are terrified of what they see as the barbarians at the gate. Perhaps they are not at all barbarians. The barbarians may be much closer than they think. And it could well be that what we have are the truth tellers at the gate. And this is the moment, I think, that we are really coming to, which is a challenge to the whole of the church, which is to really speak and do the truth. This is what is now needed. And I think he wishes to do this, whether he has the strength and power and the support to do this, because he is also a bishop. And this worries me a little bit. It worried me also when I saw the film. He is a bishop. He's the Bishop of Rome. And the tendency to protect his fellow bishops, he has to lose that. He has to actually become very ruthless.
To the point that people have even been considering the idea that if this whole process works its way out, it could see a result in the bankruptcy of the church as it currently stands.
You'd want to say, let it happen. Let it all happen. I've got a sense that we're past the stage of restoration and we're into a stage of reformation. I think a new reform is needed. It struck me listening to Mary McAleese last weekend that she's already pinning her thesis to the door of the Vatican. And this is what we're looking at now. It's no longer fiddling about. This won't do. And I am somebody who came in my early days with huge hopes of Vatican II. I'm no longer interested in people who talk about Vatican II. We're way beyond that. So Mary Collins, whom I know you're going to speak to later, she spoke about the domino effect, and this is what they fear. Let them be fearless. Let it come tumbling down, and let us then see what can grow from these ashes. We either trust in the Spirit or we don't.
Now, you talk about reformation versus restoration. Some, and there's a sizable group of people who want restoration back to almost pre-Vatican II times.
Oh, yes. I think there are, I see, there is more than two possible trajectories. We will either have very small enclaves of right-wing people holding on to what they see as the fundamentals, We will see, on the other hand, I think, groups of people gathering as Eucharistic communities in solidarity with justice and charity at the core. So it's really, you know, it will be a question of what wins out.
Brian, do you have parishioners who have a desire for restoration? Do people want to go back to something that maybe isn't there anymore?
No, I don't think so. Certainly, they like some of the old...
The nostalgia.
Well, they like some of the old rituals. I mean, nanas will bring their grandchildren to light candles under the statues of St. Anthony or the little flower. And, you know, there is, because I live in the markets area, in the fruit and vegetable markets area, there is a real sense, if you look at the full year, there's a real sense, for example, of, you know, lilies for St. Anthony, a shamrock on St. Patrick's Day, flowers, roses for the little flower for Therese of Lisieux and so on. You know, so they associate live like fish on Friday. I think we had a conversation about this before. Mm. Not because they're frightened of breaking a church rule, but because of fish and chips on a Friday has been a tradition. And so there is that thing. I like what Anne says about Reformation. I'd call it, you know, are we for maintenance or are we for mission?
Right. I want to explore two ideas in a moment, but if I could bring you in at this point, because the suggestion I think that comes from you is that this Reformation, if there is one underway, didn't happen post 1979 when John Paul II was here. It might have happened even before that.
Well, certainly in an Irish context, there were several factors which had been modernising Irish society for decades before 1979. And in modernising Irish society, they were changing the place of religion within that society. We need only think of the emphasis on economic growth from the premiership of Sean Lamass onwards, the advent of a national television service in 1961, the advent of free post-primary education. And this had a seismic impact on a population used to an unquestioning belief in their clergy. The women's movement began to question the patriarchal nature of Irish society and key church teachings. And there was also, I suppose, disappointment in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council at the limited amount of change. And this was particularly encapsulated in 1968 when the Irish people, or many of them, rejected papal interference in the bedroom. And in the 1970s, the Irish hierarchy were very much confronted, not just by declining vocations, but by a decline in Orthodox beliefs.
I know hindsight is 20/20 vision, even for historians. But if we listen back now to John Paul II and some of the speeches that he gave when he was in Ireland, you might hear a slightly different objective.
Let history record that at a difficult moment in the experience of the people of Ireland, the Bishop of Rome set foot in your land. God has his plan for the church in Ireland, but he needs you to carry it out. What the church will be in the future depends on your free cooperation with God's grace. He picks, inviting you. He who is the way and the truth and the life. Young people of Ireland, I love you.
Dahi, when you hear that speech is now in the current context, what do you hear?
Well, I think when we think of the visit, we think of one of the great public events in the history of Irish Catholicism. But when we listen to the actual words of the Pope, we can see the visit less as a celebration of Catholic Ireland and more as an unsuccessful attempt to slow down the inroads being made by materialism and secularism in Ireland.
We are constantly told that this is not a papal visit, this is part of the world meeting of families. But is there an objective that's going on for Francis? What do any of you think about that? That he may be bringing a message to Ireland again?
Well, he, right. There is an objective, I believe. And certainly over the last 2 weeks, You know, that objective has expanded to the news that we've probably pretty much had all week. And, you know, that is to, I think people have talked about truth. People have talked about acknowledgement, finally, and the work that has to be done. And, you know, Pope Francis is someone who we know and manifests the call to reach out to the margins. And I certainly would be hopeful that he and other collaborators who really want to kind of to finally deal with this will do so. So I believe that there's obviously the objective of the World Meeting of Families plus the objective of bringing Christ to the people. But there's, you know, there's an expanding and important continuing mission.
I think it's a pity, actually, that he's coming on the back, as it were, of the World Meeting of Families, because I think that brings up issues straight away about the whole question about what family means. I just wonder where this whole concept of holy family comes from. I think it's such a, it's a created construct, really, because if you look back to the Gospels, I don't get the sense that Jesus was terribly interested in families, and particularly not in holy families. So I think that actually somewhat takes away a bit, because also we now see in Ireland we have so many different forms of family life which are not included in this.
Okay. I want to stay with that World Meeting of Families for a moment, because a number of leading child protection experts in the Catholic Church addressed the World Meeting of Families. A key panel discussed the Pastoral Congress and what the safeguarding would mean. And one of those was Mary Collins. She's a former member of the Vatican Child Protection Commission and an abuse survivor. I spoke to Mary earlier and began by asking her to expand on her call for zero tolerance.
Well, I think to have real zero tolerance, you have to have in place a way of removing from the church immediately anyone who abuses a child. There should be no place for them in the church. They should be removed immediately. And the same should happen to anyone who protects them, any bishop or religious leader. They should immediately have to pay the penalty of losing their title, losing their position, and if necessary, having to leave the clerical state altogether. Real zero tolerance would mean that you would have to put in a canon law so that they would be breaking a canon law by abusing a child or by protecting an abuser, because the church doesn't seem to pay a lot of attention to civil law. Only very recently, for the first time, we saw the Pope refer to the abuse of children as a crime. And it is a crime. And up to now, really, a lot of people in the church and the bishops have only been willing to look at something if it was canon law, if they were going to have to pay a penalty under canon law. So therefore you have to bring in the most stringent penalties and put them into canon law. And I know when I was on the commission, and sometimes we brought up these things where, you know, we would want this done or that done, and we were told, oh, you can't do that in canon law. Well, the thing is, you write a new canon law, you change canon law. You know, it's simple. It may not be simple in terms of the church and the way they do things and the length of time they take to do things, but when you're thinking of every day it goes by another child is being abused, you cannot delay. You know, the Pope himself in his letter has admitted there's been this delay, but it's decades of delay. Decades have gone by, and we still don't have... What really is necessary is a universal policy to halt this in its tracks, not just firefighting each country as it happens. Ireland, we get new safeguarding policies. Australia, they get new policies. America, they get policies. It's got to be everywhere. And if the policy is strong and it's working, and the only policy in the world that has the strength of canon law and has mandatory reporting is in America, and they say it's working there, well, then put it in everywhere, you know?
But there's still an effort, for example, to introduce a statute of limitations. You're still getting lean back.
Well, this is just dreadful, because we're told, you know, the church is on the side of the victims. And when you look at it, they are trying very hard to fight the changes that are wanted in America as well as in other countries to do away with the statutes of limitations on this particular crime of child abuse. And if the statute of limitations were removed or changed, it would mean more perpetrators could be tried in a criminal court and justice would be brought to more survivors. And yet the church are fighting against it with their lawyers. Now, how does that sit with saying we're on the side of the survivors, we're on the side of the victims? You can't say one thing and do the opposite.
Mary, you were to be with us in the studio, but for a very good reason. You will find yourself later in Dublin Castle. What do you hope to hear?
I don't know. I mean, the Pope is going to be speaking, I think, at a couple of points during his visit here, but I'm hoping while he is here, we will hear at some point him say what he is now going to do. He has said we need accountability, we need to hold these men accountable, we need to hold the men who cover up accountable. But he's telling us what we already know and what those of us who have been speaking out for years have been calling for. So at this stage, it's at the point now where he must tell us how he is going to do it and when he's going to do it, and that's what I'm hoping to hear.
If he called for your help, would you offer it?
I would, of course, but, you know... I was on his commission for 3 years, and we tried to help, and he did approve our recommendations. But as we know, the very thing he's talking about—a way of holding church leaders accountable for covering up or protecting abusers—we recommended an accountability tribunal 3 years ago. He approved it, but it went to his curia, to the CDF, and they wouldn't implement it.
Finally, on Sunday, you won't be at the Phoenix Park, but you will, in fact, be in the Garden of Remembrance.
I will indeed, because the Stand for Truth meeting has been held there, and I think originally there was an idea that by the organisers of the World Meeting of Families that maybe they could airbrush abuse, the subject and the victims and the survivors, out of this whole visit. Not have the Pope meet anybody, not have the Pope speak about it. And at that time, everyone, I think, stood up and said, well, we're not going to be ignored. And this gathering, it's not a protest against the visit of the Pope. It's simply a showing of solidarity of survivors and their supporters and their families and anyone who wants to come along. And really, it is just to show that survivors are not going to be invisible and they're not going to be airbrushed out of history, and they're not going away. You know, we're here and we're going to keep speaking out because we don't want to see more children have the same thing happen to them that happened to us.
Mary Collins, who spoke to us earlier on this morning. And the papal aircraft has landed and is taxiing in. We'll go to the airport shortly. I just want to go back to the panel to get some comments on what we heard from Mary. And very clear message coming.
Absolutely. It's the time for action. I mean, this is a woman of huge moral authority. I do wish Francis would invite her back to the Vatican and give her a proper official position there. Why on earth should the Curia be there blocking the recommendations that are made by that commission and endorsed by him? So please invite her back.
It's time for antiquated canon law to be updated, and that is one of the major reasons why reform has not been implemented.
Brian, do you feel reassured that there's somebody like Mary Collins pushing that door?
I would love to see Mary Collins, join again the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. I would love to see maybe something like a more powerful organisation looking after the protection of minors. I pray for the day that Mary Collins and people like Colin O'Gorman will say, finally, we believe the church is walking in the right direction. I pray for that day.
Well, it's all about to happen very shortly now because the 36-hour visit is underway. Let's go to Dublin Airport. Our reporter there is Rona Tarrant. Rona, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
So we are, I believe the aircraft has touched down and landed at Dublin Airport. Can you describe the scene for us?
Well, actually, as you're just talking to me now, the aircraft is just pulling up to us here in the media area. On the windows, we can see an Irish flag and a papal flag. And on the runway, they're greeting clergy and representatives of the government who are just waiting to greet them. It is quite loud here, so apologies for the background noise. In terms of weather, it's a very dry morning here at Dublin Airport, clear skies, a small bit cold for August, but otherwise no rain, thankfully. and those on the runway will be quite glad of that this morning. In front of us here, just to my right, are clergy and representatives of government. As I said, they're waiting to greet the Pope. Now, that group includes Taoiseach Simon Coveney, his wife Ruth Coveney, and their three children are there as well. They're about to present Pope Francis with flowers. Now, also representing the state here at the airport this morning are the Ambassador to the Holy See, Emma Madigan, also the Mayor of Fingal as well, Councillor Anthony Lavin. Of course, basically all of the church leaders are here this morning. Cardinal Kevin Farrell himself, head of the Vatican Department for Laity, Family and Life, originally a Dubliner, spent a lot of time in Texas and was formerly Bishop of Dallas before taking up his role in Rome. Now, as I said, Cardinal Sean Brady is here this morning, along with Archbishop of Armagh, Eamon Martin, of course, Archbishop Dermot Martin of Dublin, Archbishop of Tuam, Michael Neary, Archbishop Kieran O'Reilly of Cashel and Emly, and Church of Ireland Archbishop Michael Jackson is also here as well. As I said, it is the World Meeting of Families that the Pope is here for, so there are a number of families, and there is one family in particular on the runway to greet Pope Francis this morning, and that is the Boland family, Rory and Maura Boland, and their three children, and they will be presenting the Pope with vestments this morning.
Okay, well, the apparently the steps are still to go up to the aircraft. So what we'll do is we'll take a very quick break and join you back for the opening of the door. Rona.
My name is Alex McGrath, and I'm down in the park here today, hopefully to send a message to the Pope and explain to him about homelessness in Dublin. I remember in 1979, when Pope John Paul was here, homelessness was a thing we knew nothing about, never heard of it. And 40 years on now, Pope Francis is coming, and this country has gone backwards as regards to looking after homeless people. There's so many families and children walking around the streets of Dublin today. It's unreal when you see them. Not an awful lot of people notice them. I notice them because of being in that situation myself. And to see the children walking the streets, being dragged around the streets with their mothers and fathers all day long waiting for somewhere to sleep. And I wish the Pope could see that. 40 years ago, it was so different. And how it's come to this is beyond me.
That's Alex McGrath with one of a series of messages to the Pope, which were compiled by our colleague Philip Bromwell. Let's go back to Dublin Airport now. And Rona, the press, I believe, are already off the aircraft and you're awaiting the opening of the front door.
Yeah, so the press corps, there's about 70 journalists on the plane with the Pope this morning, and as I speak, they are still disembarking. Now, they're coming out of the back door, and we're expecting then that the steps will be brought up to the front door, where Pope Francis will be brought out. Now, the Papal Nuncio will actually walk up the steps, and he'll invite the Pope to come down and to greet the dignitaries below. Now, on the plane with the Pope this morning, obviously his own delegation that usually travel with him. Now, that includes the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, for example, the Pope's doctor always travels with him, a small number of cardinals and bishops and priests, as well as some laity, mostly employees of the Vatican Press Office, for example, and then some plainclothes agents of the Vatican Security Service and the Swiss Guard. So the steps are just being brought up to the front of the plane at the moment, and they're just bringing the carpet up as we speak. So the clergy, as I mentioned, are on the side, and they're waiting, I suppose, for the doors to open.
Now, Rona, the Pope flies Alitalia when he goes to a country, but I believe he will be using Aer Lingus both to Knock and on the way home.
Yes, he does actually. So this morning it's an Alitalia AZ4000, and that's the flight number he always uses. But as is his custom, he usually takes the country's flagship carrier. So tomorrow, I mean, he's actually going to be back at this airport tomorrow morning on his way to Knock. He'll be flying with Aer Lingus, and that is obviously the same airline that carried Pope John Paul II in 1979 during his visit to Ireland. Aer Lingus tomorrow will be operating an A321, the St Aidan, for the visit, and the St Dervla will be on standby. Now, slight modifications have been made to the aircraft. The papal coat of arms, for example, has been applied to the exterior, and the divider curtains have been installed. The papal flag and the Irish tricolour will be flown from the cockpit for both pushback and landing into both Dublin and Knock airports, and the papal flag and the Italian flag will be flown upon landing in Ciampino airport when they are actually back in Rome tomorrow. The plane is accommodating 126 guests, as I mentioned earlier, including Pope Francis, members of the Vatican,
and then of course members of the wider Vatican delegation, security staff and journalists. Now as I'm looking up, they've just placed the steps up to the front door of the plane. The Papal Nuncio is at the top of the steps, and at the bottom of the steps, Simon Coveney is actually the first to greet the Pope as he'll walk down the plane. Now his three young daughters are with him, as are his wife. Right behind them then are the Boland family. I see the Lord Mayor of Fingal is there as well, and then of course all of the church leaders.
And we're not expecting, of course, Pope Francis to address anybody at this point other than the dignitaries that are welcoming him.
Yeah, it's a very tight turnaround here. Now, it's a 15 minutes, actually. So he's going to be opening the door. It's not really a ceremony, actually. It's just more of a greeting. So after that, he's going to be taken by car straight to Áras an Uachtaráin, where there'll be a welcome ceremony for him in front of the presidential residence. And of course, he'll meet Michael D. Higgins. Then he'll go on to Dublin Castle at 12. So he is getting actually quite a lot in this morning, despite landing at 10:30. Just to mention, the car he's using this morning is a Skoda Rapide. Skoda is the official car partner for the visit, and I suppose Pope Francis is well known to favour more modest modes of transport. Flight operations, I should say, at Dublin Airport are not affected this morning, though it is a huge operation here at Dublin Airport, a massive Garda presence here this morning, as well as the DAA.
So in the last couple of moments, everything seems to be in place for the arrival. We know that he's here safe and sound, and will be heading very shortly, of course, to Áras an Uachtaráin for the first official function. Rona,
yes,
I think
exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just about to say they're just about to open the doors, but I'd say you're a bit caught for time there.
We probably are. So we'll thank you indeed for giving us that on the spot arrival of Pope Francis. Brian, of course, you with your aviation interest will probably be able to tell us that he arrived early and spent a little bit of time circling over Bray.
I just asked you that because I know you're an aviator yourself. He was in the hold for a while there, I say, simply because they wanted to kind of have it timed to get him onto the runway and onto the Echoes and Bravos and onto the parking
and
ramp.
And get him into where he's going.
I could just see a little bit of the welcoming party there, but I noticed to the naming of all the dignitaries, and I thought there's an opportunity missed here. There's going to be so many opportunities missed, but I wanted to see some representatives of what we might call the New Ireland there. I was hoping when somebody mentioned some family or other there, I was hoping that's what they were going to say.
Mm. Simon Covey's children are there, aren't they? Not New Ireland people. Someday. Someday.
Yeah. That's not quite what I meant.
Yeah. I know.
Okay, well, with that in mind, we hope to actually hear as well from Tony Connolly, who is the European editor of RTE, who was on the flight. And as soon as we make contact with him, we'll follow that through. Let's go back to, backstory to what's happening in this whole visit, and what's been involved in it too, has been a subcurrent, an undercurrent. And one of the speakers at the World Meeting of Families that drew attention in particular was Father James Martin. And over 1,200 people attended his session at the World Meeting of Families. James is an American Jesuit priest. He's editor-at-large of the Jesuit magazine America, and he's the author of Building a Bridge. And he received a standing ovation on Thursday for his presentation, Showing Welcome and Respect in Our Parishes for LGBT People and Their Families. Well, I spoke with James on his arrival in Ireland and began our conversation by asking him what his objectives were in his presentation. Actually, sorry, we'll come to that in a moment, but the doors are open and I think we can actually go back to Rona.
Yeah, so the doors are open here at Dublin Airport. We can see actually Pope Francis has just emerged from the plane. Now, the Papal Nuncio walked up the steps a few moments ago. He greeted him on the plane and he invited him down. Now, he's just at the top of the steps at the moment and he's making his way down quite slowly. It is a small bit breezy here at Dublin Airport, but otherwise the weather is absolutely beautiful. So down at the bottom of the steps here, we see him walking up to Tánaiste Simon Coveney. He's being greeted there at the bottom of the steps, and Simon Coveney appears to be his second eldest daughter, has just presented Pope Francis with a bunch of flowers, and he's having a conversation with her now. So he's standing there at the bottom of the steps. Now Simon Coveney is also shaking hands with Pope Francis, and he's being followed down the steps by members of his own delegation. So at the bottom of the steps, he appears to still be talking to the Coveneys, and he's greeting Simon Coveney's wife Ruth. Following him down then on the plane are his own delegation, and he's making his way down now to the family, the Boland family, and that is Rory and Maura Boland and their three children, Jane, Daniel and Tom. Now, they're actually presenting Pope Francis with vestments, which he's expected to wear at some point during his visit. So he's just speaking to them there at the moment. Obviously, he is here for the World Meeting of Families. So they brought that family along, I suppose, as a sort of a symbol of why he is here and what, I suppose, prompted the visit in the first place. Now, he's sort of making his way down, and the next person that he is greeting is the Mayor of Fingal. Obviously, Dublin Airport is in his constituency. Now, that is Councillor Anthony Lavin. So he's making his way down. He's also greeting the ambassador to the Holy See, Emma Madigan, also another representative of the Irish government. Now, once he finishes greeting, I suppose, the members of the government, he'll then move on to the church leaders. So at the moment, we see him. We're just a bit blocked by a few of the cameras. But just to say, the representatives of the Irish clergy, Cardinal Sean Brady is here this morning, along with Archbishop of Dublin, Diarmaid Martin, the Archbishop, of course, of Armagh, Eamon Martin, Archbishop of Tuam, Michael Neary, and Archbishop Kieran O'Reilly of Cashel and Emly, and also the Church of Ireland Archbishop Michael Jackson is also here. So the Pope is making his way along, and he's greeting a few of them at the moment. And as I said, once he finishes with his greetings, there's going to be a very quick turnaround, and then he's going to be, his car is actually waiting and has just pulled up for him here. It's a Skoda Rapide, and that's going to take him straight to Orsanuchtaron.
Excellent, Rod. I suppose a couple of quick comments as we go round from what we saw. No kissing the ground, as we saw in 1979. Of course, he doesn't do that anyway.
No, but we certainly did see the charismatic side of Pope Francis. He was smiling. But I think I was just saying to Brian earlier just how struck I was by his age. He wasn't moving so freely. And the other thing that struck me was the order in which he greeted people. Far down the line were members of the Irish Church.
Of the Irish Church. Bearing in mind, of course, John Paul was 57 when he was in Ireland. So there is quite an age difference as well. Anne?
I was just noticing there that I think the last person he was coming to greet there was Michael Jackson, who's the Church of Ireland Archbishop. Mm. And one of the things that Pope Francis is very strong on is ecumenical relationships. And he really is. I mean, it's one of the very... significant things about him. He talks about all being children of Abraham and so on, and the same God. And I noticed that there was a greeting in the mentioned the other day from one of the imams to him also, and a nice piece also in the Irish Times today from Gordon Linney. So these are positive things. Yes,
Brian.
Yeah, we I mentioned this to you there, Michael, just a few days ago, that we have been celebrating the World Meeting of Families Seven Church Pilgrim Walk in our parish in St. Mickens and Halton Street, along with six other churches and the Pro Cathedral. Now, one of them is the Church of Ireland Church St. Michael's, which is on Church Street. Probably people would know it famously because of the mummies, and people can go down to the vault. So I met Archbishop Michael Jackson because Archbishop Martin and Archbishop Jackson launched the Seven Church Pilgrim Walk. And very importantly, the ecumenical dimension is to be seen there. And so I was delighted, to see the Archbishop Jackson among bishops and others to greet the Pope as he came down from the plane there.
Very good. Well, before we actually had the arrival there, we were just setting up an interview that I did earlier with Father James Martin. As I said, he was one of the speakers at the World Meeting of Families, with a particularly large amount of interest in his topic, because he was talking about showing welcome and respect for our parishes. And as I said, I began our conversation by asking him what his objectives were in his presentation.
I will be providing insights for parishes about the lives of LGBT Catholics based on my conversations with them. And I will also be providing some best practices based on conversations I've had with parishes who do successful LGBT outreach work.
What is the gap between how it is now and how it should be then in that case?
It depends on when you're talking about and in what country you're talking about. In some places in the United States, for example, LGBT Catholics feel very welcome. They are very much a part of the community. In other parts of the U.S., and certainly in parts of the world, LGBT Catholics feel really like they're pariahs in the church. They're not welcome in their own church. So it's a pretty vast distance, depending on where you are and who your pastor is.
James, in your book Building a Bridge, you talk about the sensitivity of language. And in this particular discussion, language hurts.
It does. Language, to begin with, language in the catechism, many LGBT people have told me has been very hurtful for them, the language of intrinsic disorder. But even the language people are using now to blame all LGBT people or gay priests for pedophilia, that language hurts people and drives people away from the church. And there's so much homophobia in Catholic circles, particularly in the far right, that it's not surprising that people feel driven away from the church and that the church has to go the extra mile to welcome them.
James, since we spoke last, Pennsylvania has come to the forefront, and you actually are quite close to that particular area. In fact, you're from there.
I am. I'm from Pennsylvania, and this is a terrible thing for Pennsylvania, but really for the whole United States, and I think for the whole church. It's a very strange case because most of these cases are very old. And these are 300 or so priests who had abused over the past 7 years, and I think something like 95% of them were before 2002. Nonetheless, I think that people are just horrified by the kinds of cases we're reading about, how disgusting they are, and I think it just reminds people again of this terrible history. And I think it's actually worse than 2002, because I think in 2002, at least in the United States, people were looking at individual cases, and mainly in Boston, the Archdiocese of Boston with Cardinal Law, and saying, look at these terrible cases. But for the most part, didn't understand it as a sort of systemic problem. Now, I think with this release of these documents in Pennsylvania, they see it as this historic systemic problem. And I think people are angrier now, because I covered this in 2002, and I think they're angrier.
You're a Jesuit. Can you give us anything from your insight and your formation that might give Francis what he needs to fix this?
Yeah, it's the bad Jesuit that tells the Pope what to do. But I would say that, the key thing for me is, well, number one, getting all of the cases out. All right. The only way forward is for all the archdioceses and dioceses and religious orders to open up their files completely, period. Just open them up, bring it all out, say, look, this is our history. Because otherwise it's going to be this steady drip, drip, drip of cases coming out, you know, every year or two. Number two, putting some teeth into the rules that govern what happened to bishops, not only when they are guilty of abuse themselves, but when they cover up. And number three, getting lay people involved. I frankly think every review board should be run by lay people. And then certainly putting into place guidelines for training of men in seminaries and religious houses of formation where they have some real psychosexual understanding of who they are and of chastity. Because, you know, we were always told in the novitiate, you can't live your chastity in a healthy way if you don't understand your sexuality in a healthy way. And I've run across more than a few repressed priests and people who seem like they're just about ready to explode. People who are very uncomfortable talking about anything about sexuality. People who are uncomfortable around women, right? And you have to wonder, you know, who are we training today? So I think it's essential for us to really look at the training as well. So looking backwards and looking ahead too.
Father James Martin, who I spoke to during the week, and of course with the Pennsylvania information coming on top of everything that was known already, this is where I suppose the focus is coming now. Brian, you were nodding during that piece, particularly about his comment about the recruitment.
Yeah, I think Father James Martin, I shook hands with him briefly at the Congress, at the one of the afternoons. I wasn't able to get to the talk. What he says ticks a lot of boxes. Look, the reality is formation for priesthood, formation for religious life, like any kind of formation. I mean, we ought to be second to none in terms of training. You know, young people for religious life, young men for priesthood. You know, people for ministry. I mean, and you know, I often say to people, you know, why go for the bronze medal? Why not go for the gold? Do you see? So, I mean, like training in terms of as he said, proper, mature psychosexual formation, very, very good, very comprehensive, very progressive theology,
philosophy.
A vocation
prayer.
Not based on power, is what you're
Absolutely
saying.
Absolutely not, yeah. No. I mean, St. Francis, I'm very struck that Pope Francis took, took the name Francis. Francis was about repair my house, repair my church. There's good things about the church. There's very important things about the church. And we build from there. And it's an ongoing, it's a developing, it's an evolving, mission, as I say.
Anne?
I think we should stay with everything that James Martin said there. I think he hit all, ticked all the boxes. Mm-hmm. And again, you would like him up there organising all of this. So he put his finger on the training. When I think about it, very young, often emotionally inadequate, sexually inexperienced young men were hothoused in seminaries where they were possibly even exposed to the first sexual predators. I mean, this really was appalling. And so that is where the thing has to start, is how they are trained. And also even the idea of just bringing all these young men together, the whole thing about the all-male priesthood. Very few people have a gift for celibacy, and yet all of these secular priests are supposed to be celibate. So that's terribly important. Every single point that he made there needs to be put into practice. And the most critical thing of all is that the whole truth must come out. And we will not all find ourselves on the side of the angels. And that is also absolutely true. But the whole truth will eventually make us free. And that is the only way to go.
Dahi?
I couldn't agree more. James Martin mentioned the importance of involving the laity in a meaningful way. He mentioned the importance of opening up the files and of rules for bishops who are seen to either shield abusers or abuse themselves. The very things that Mary Collins mentioned in her own interview and in her own letter of resignation last year.
One, if I may, there's just one other point I wanted to make. We know all the structures need to be changed, but Pope Francis is also a man of gesture who understands the significance of gestures. So I've been thinking a lot over these days, what symbolic gesture could be made? For example, he uses to huge power the washing of the feet in many situations. So I kind of had this image of him calling in all his, his curia, his cardinals, his bishops, and inviting them to lay down their red hats, lay down their mitres, remove their fancy dress, if you like, remove all of the princely trappings of a monarchical church, and follow him out dressed in black for a Via Dolorosa of repentance.
Mm-hmm. The humiliation of the church is happening right now. And that is also going to, in many cases, offend and upset a great deal of people who are very traditional in their outlook.
It's not humiliation. It's actually a church acknowledging its faults and failings.
Well, there we are. We're almost to the end of the programme. Very quickly around to the panel. Brian, if I might start with you, your expectations for the next 36 hours.
I'm very hopeful. I'm very excited. I'm delighted he's going to the Capuchin Day Centre for Homeless.
Anne?
Let us hope for some words of compassion and words of truth.
Bye.
A very meaningful apology, more than was offered by his predecessor.
Father Brian Shortall, Dr. Anne Thurston and Dr. Dahi O'Coran, thank you for joining us on this Leap of Faith special.